Our brains are fascinating. They control everything from our ability to function to experiencing emotion. In fact, your ability to understand what I'm saying to you right now comes down to the amazing functionality of your brain. And yet there is still so much that we don't understand about how our minds work. So what happens when things go wrong up here? Well, to find out the answers, we came here to Nizhny Novgorod and speak with Igor Medyanik. He is one of the world's foremost neurosurgeons utilizing state-of-the-art technology and progressive techniques.
During an awake brain surgery, the patient is fully conscious.
How accurate is this method?
We were operating on a young woman with a brain tumor. We asked her to recite a poem. And when she finished the poem, I realized she couldn't talk. Thankfully, her ability to speak came back after 3 days. And we've been good friends ever since.
How do you know where not to go?
If a person stops speaking or produces an irrelevant word, this means to us that the inhibition worked.
That an operating room is like an orchestra, where everyone has to know what they're doing and when they must do it.
You perform brain surgery to remove tumors, and the patients that you're operating on have a type of anesthesia where they are still awake. Talk to me a little bit about what the patient is feeling. Is this kind of a state in between dream and being awake, or are they fully conscious during this process? What does the patient feel?
During an awake brain surgery, the patient is fully conscious. Because they're completely awake, we're able to precisely identify the borders between different areas of the brain. If the patient were in a semi-conscious state, we wouldn't be able to determine our distance from the specific neural pathways associated with speech.
So once the skull is open and they're on the table, what do they actually feel? I mean, do they feel any pain? Do they feel any, or is it the difference between being able to speak and actually being able to feel something? What do they feel at that moment?
Upon awakening, the patient doesn't feel any pain at all. We use a special type of regional anesthesia when the nerve endings all the way around the head are numbed, so there is no pain at all. However, as we remove the tumor, there might be areas of the brain where a person may feel some pain. We're aware of this problem and always factor it in. For example, if the tumor reaches all the way to the bottom of the cranial fossa, the floor of the cranial cavity, we know that the patient could experience discomfort during surgery. In that case, we will sometimes remove the part of the tumor that is likely to cause the pain, but only if we are certain it wouldn't affect the patient's quality of life. After that, we wake the patient up and remove the rest of the tumor in the more hard-to-reach areas.
So our bodies make many uncontrollable movements, a little flinches, a little tick here and there. That can be incredibly dangerous when you're actually operating on someone. What sort of safety precautions do you use to make sure that the patient does not move while you are operating on them? Is it something as extreme as, do you really have to tie them down or clamp them down to the table?
Firstly, not everyone is suitable for awake surgeries. Some patients are, shall we say, less psychologically stable than others. If there is a tantrum or some involuntary movement during the operation, that could be dangerous, which is why, before every surgery, patients undergo a series of tests with a psychologist, a neurosurgeon, and an anesthesiologist. We talk to the patient and see if they're comfortable with awake surgery. Secondly, yes, we do secure the patient's body before surgery. For cranial fixation, we use a special device called the Mayfield skull clamp. It doesn't hurt the patient, but ensures that the skull is held tight in position. The patient is strapped down on the table and can still make small movements, but their head is completely immobilized. Using neuronavigational technology, we identify various areas of the brain by looking at special reference points, so it's very important for the patient's head to stay fixed. One more thing, the patient has to remain on the operating table for 2 to 3 hours, virtually motionless. Even for a healthy person, that's quite challenging. So when we place the patient on the table, we try to make sure they're comfortable. We smooth out all the folds, put an object under their feet, etc., to make their posture as natural as possible.
So it's hard for me to imagine being in this position, actually being on the table, having someone working on my brain. And I hope I never have to be in this position. But has it ever happened where, while you're operating, the patient starts to misbehave or you notice something is going wrong or not the way that you'd like it to go? What happens in your mind in that moment?
That's not exactly how it works. We talk to our patients before the surgery and go over all the potential complications. You might have noticed that we first stimulate the cortex and then the subcortical structures to determine the distance from the neural pathways involved in movement and speech. Occasionally, as we stimulate the brain, a person might have an epileptic seizure, even if they've never had one before in their life. Naturally, patients get scared when this happens, but we taught them through these scenarios beforehand. We've got our methods to stop the seizure and keep the person lucid. Once they calm down, we resume the surgery.
I mean, it's possible that what you're doing can cause damages that are irreversible.
It's a myth. Opening a skull does no lasting damage to the brain tissue. It's a well-established fact. Surgery like this is relatively common. We open skulls of both awake and unconscious patients. It doesn't damage the brain tissue on its own, unless we damage the functional areas, of course. Successful surgery makes patients and neurosurgeons happy.
My understanding, the idea of your approach is that the tumor has no specific boundaries. But you have a neurolinguist present to help you kind of figure out where those boundaries are in real time. So how accurate is this method?
There's a method called stimulation. We know that 1 milliampere roughly translates into 1 millimeter to the pathway, responsible for language skills and motion. If we set, say, 10 or 20 milliamperes and we see distortion, we know that we are 10 to 20 millimeters from the pathway, and we can go further safely. We do that. We see that there are no tumor cells left there, and we still have 0.5 centimeter to the pathway, so we can safely remove a few more millimeters of tissue, because, as you noted correctly, brain tumors are invasive. They don't form an eggshell. They infiltrate the surrounding tissues, sadly. We have to do that, remove, mute, so to speak, areas of the brain that won't cause any disorders after the surgery.
Just to be clear for our viewers, it's important for you to have the neurolinguist with you in the operating theater at that moment while you're operating, correct?
Techniques like this do exist. It's the easiest for us to identify language and motion centers. And these zones, it has to be said that the left hemisphere of the human brain is responsible for the right side of the body, and the right is responsible for the left side, respectively. If you're right-handed, your left hemisphere is dominant, and all these important structures are there. Sometimes the tumor is in the right hemisphere. It's not dominant, obviously, but it still has certain functions, like cognitive and spatial orientation. Techniques exist to perform special tests during surgery. For example, during surgery of the right non-dominant part of the frontal lobe, tests will help to find the boundaries of the tumor and do not harm the patient. It's more difficult, of course, although it doesn't stop neurosurgeons from using such techniques.
Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today. This is a fascinating subject. So, Let's get right into it. So you know that a specific part of the brain is responsible for speech, but every single brain is different. So when you're getting ready to work with someone who's going into surgery, how do you know what parts to work with and what parts to stay away from? Is there some imagery? Do they light up on a computer screen somehow? Talk to me about that process.
Welcome to our Center for Language and Brain. You're right. There is a typical map of language in the brain. It's mostly left lateralized in most of the people, even left-handed. But during the growth of a tumor, the entire network is reorganized. So beforehand, we just don't know where language is in this specific person. So we need to do a very specific procedure, which is called intraoperative language mapping, and identify them.
Interesting. So we know that in order to map out that those speech areas, you do tests with each individual patient. You speak with them, have them do maneuvers, if you will, with their brain. Are they different for each patient? Maybe someone who's good at math, they do math problems. Someone who's good at music, maybe listen to music. How do you know where to work with in a person's brain?
Brain is not equipotential. There is functional specialization for language, for other cognitive functions. And within language, there is different areas of the brain are involved in various aspects of language. For example, the temporal lobe of the left hemisphere is mostly doing language processing, language comprehension. The frontal lobes are more involved in language production. So depending on where we are, we select specific tests sensitive enough for this specific area.
So when we were actually in the surgery, we were watching this whole process, how do you know, you're speaking to the patient is aware of what's happening. How do you know where not to go? Is it something that you can see on the computer again, or is it as simple as putting a do not touch here sticker actually on the brain? Mm-hmm.
For example, we're in the inferior frontal lobe. So the most specific test for it is action naming. So we present pictures of actions, mm-hmm. And ask, what is the hero doing in a picture?
Okay.
For example, sitting, jumping, dancing. We present each probe for 4 seconds. This is a very strict protocol. And during those 4 seconds, a neurosurgeon stimulates the brain, inhibiting this specific half of centimeter area. And if a person stops speaking or produces an irrelevant word, this means to us that the inhibition worked and this area is eloquent for language. We mark it with a specific sticker, and the neurosurgeon makes his best not to resect this area.
So neurolinguistics and neurosurgery, very different fields. I mean, one involves cutting into the brain and one involves studying the brain. And do you have to have some experience in actual neurosurgery in order to understand what he's doing? Do you talk to me a little bit about your experience there?
There is no formal education for that. This is what we learn during actual work. And it takes a lot of time to train our students doing that. Of course, we should speak the same language with the neurosurgeon. We should know very well the stages of neurosurgery. We should interact in a very coherent way. That's why I would say we should be aware of many neurosurgery details. But in turn, a neurosurgeon learns neurolinguistics with us. So they know which area is involved in which aspect of language. And the neurosurgeons we are working with are very linguistically informed. They know about phonemes, morphemes, and syntax.
What can, and I guess this can be different for each individual case, but talk to me a little bit about what does brain damage do to a person's ability to speak?
The sequences can be different. Production and comprehension can be impaired We could end up with a global aphasia when a person cannot understand any language and cannot produce a word. That's very rare after neurosurgery. It's more relevant for post-stroke aphasias, for example. If we wouldn't do the intraoperative mapping, the neurological and language negative consequences would be much more numerous. There are a lot of multi-center studies devoted to that, and this is proven already.
You have devoted much of your life to studying the brain. You have become the head of the center here, so you know what you're talking about. In your time, what has been the most fascinating, the most interesting, the most important discovery about the human brain that you can think of?
In fact, one of those is very recent. Last year, the colleagues from the west of the US published a study with patients reported with implanted electrodes, with electrocorticography, where they recorded the brain activity and then synthesized speech. They made it for 50 words, well-trained many times, but I consider that a super great step forward in this field. And we have already started working on that as well.
Very cool. Thank you for taking the time with us today. I look forward to following more of your work.
Thank you very much.
People have specific talents. For example, there are athletes, there are artists. One example that I've heard is that someone was actually playing the violin during the surgery because that's something that is important to them, to their livelihood. What do you need to do to specify or to make your surgery specific to a patient and what their talents are?
There are certain specifics, sure. The first one is that multilingual persons who can speak several languages have more language centers, one for each language they know. I'm Ukrainian, so I have dedicated centers for Ukrainian and Russian languages. This is also true for you, one for English and one for Russian. In such cases, we have to invite linguists to assist us. We had a Tatar patient some time ago. Nobody here knew the Tatar language, so we had to adapt our tests and invite an interpreter who asked questions for us. When it comes to violin playing, well, I've seen the videos. But playing the violin involves so many structures in your brain that damaging one of them will hardly have any considerable effect on this ability. Only the manual dexterity is critical here, so we usually test language zones. Sometimes it's also sight and motion zones.
I've heard of one method, or an alternative method, where a special dye is injected into the brain, and the tumor illuminates maybe a pink color, and the rest of the brain illuminates a blue color so that the surgeon can see the difference between where the tumor is and where the brain or the healthy brain tissue is. How is your method different, or even better in this case?
You really can't call this an alternative method. The two methods complement each other. It sometimes happens that a tumor spreads to the neural pathways, which are then fully surrounded by tumor cells. And if that happens, using a dye to identify the tumor will help us see the tumor, but won't help us see the neural pathways locked inside it. And the risk is that we can damage them, whereas ensuring quality of life for our patients is our priority. This is why I'm saying that these methods complement each other. For example, today we had a case of a low-grade glioma, and contrast enhancement doesn't really work well for them. It's hard to see them clearly, whereas it works well for high-grade tumors. But as I already mentioned, the two methods are complementary, and today, for example, I use both, as well as ultrasound, to help me locate all the bits of the tumor I was removing, because even though they joke that the surgeon's eye can see everything, it's not entirely true, and we need all the methods we can use to help us see what we need. There is also optical coherence tomography, OCT, and we use that too. It helps us see where the tumor ends and healthy tissue begins.
So, as we've already mentioned, you work with a neurolinguist to make sure that your work is properly done. In terms of what type of a relationship do you have to build with that neurolinguist? It seems to me that you would have to have a lot of trust in that person. Is this something where you've worked together a long time and have developed a relationship where you know each other's language and know how each other operate? Or is it something where it's standardized and they just come in and do their job and you come in and do your job?
Our chief neurolinguist once said that an operating room is like an orchestra, where everyone has to know what they're doing and when they must do it. The patient is usually seen by a neurolinguist prior to the surgery. Sometimes the patients have certain difficulties speaking, and during the test, it's hard for us to know whether we've come too close to the neural pathways or the pathways are already damaged and causing the defect. This is why the neurolinguists first see the patients before the surgery and then help us during the procedure. I once counted a total of 11 people in my OR, including myself, my assistant, neurolinguists, anesthesiologists, nurses, and all these people know their segment of work and know what to do and when. And certainly the surgeon tells them when he needs their assistance. Working as a team, we produce pretty good results, ensuring good quality of life for our patients.
Other than removing brain tumors, what are some other situations where someone might need to have open brain surgery?
Yes, tumors aren't the only reason for open brain surgery. Our teams operate on patients who suffer from epilepsy. If we know, for example, the problem originates in the temporal lobe, we can perform temporal resection. We're talking about the so-called mute zone, the removal of which won't lead to any disorders. This procedure, however, also requires the assistance of linguists during the operation. When dealing with epilepsy, you need to remove the whole area that generates these seizures. Otherwise, they may come back.
So it takes a lot of study, a lot of practice, a lot of knowledge to do what you do. But it's also said that there is so much that we don't yet understand about the human brain and how it works, how we think, why we think, our soul, everything is connected to this. Given all of that information, is it possible to say that there's a lot of luck in what you do?
Of course, the operating neurosurgeon plays the leading role. He has the most experience, so he can see, understand, and plan better. I, for example, know that right now I'm going in this particular direction. You asked me about my work with neurolinguists. Each pathway has a stronger response to specific tests. If I'm going towards a specific pathway, I'm asking for one set of tests. If I'm going towards a different pathway, I'm asking for a different set of tests. In the early stages, we had an interesting incident. We were operating on a young woman with a brain tumor. We were working near the so-called Aslan tract. We asked her to recite a poem. She's reciting it cheerfully as I'm removing the tumor. I can see it's there. I'm working on it. And when she finished the poem, I realized she couldn't talk. There are specialized tests for each tract, which we must use at every stage. But life is a journey. We keep learning. Thankfully, her ability to speak came back after 3 days. And we've been good friends ever since. As a student, I decided I wanted to be a neurosurgeon because there were still many unexplored areas in neurosurgery. I was young and bold. I wanted to make discoveries, to learn more about our brain. However, the more I learn, the more questions emerge. I realize I don't know this, I don't know that. It's true, unfortunately. There are some situations where every neurosurgeon needs luck. Can't argue with that. But apart from that, you need knowledge. We may lack complete understanding, but we do know something. We know that if we operate in this area, we won't do the patient any harm, while operating in that area could be dangerous. Something like that.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and watch you work and to have this experience. It has been fascinating from the beginning to end. Thank you.
Thank you very much.